As we just heard, the title of my lectures is Deep Brains as Solitons. So let me start by briefly outlining the plan of the lecture. So in the first part, I'll review the conjectures for tachyon potential on a D-brain. Then, since we'll be doing most of our studies of these conjectures in string field theory, I'll try to give a brief introduction to string field theory. Open string field theory. And then finally, I'll discuss the verification of these conjectures. Using string field theory. Okay. And in this, I'll discuss two aspects. Okay. First, the concrete numerical approach. And then analytical approach to this problem. Okay. But all in the context of string field theory. Okay, so let me then begin by saying a few words about D-brains. A D-P brain or a Dirichlet P brain in simple terms is just a p-dimensional object. In string theory, okay. So in particular, a D0 is like a particle, D1 is like a string, and so on. And these objects can move around in space, twist and turn, just like an ordinary object will do. Now, we will focus most of our attention on a special kind of D-brains. Okay. And so, first of all, we will consider flat space-time. Although, many of the results that I will be discussing hold also in curved space-time. Okay. And then, I'll consider flat D-brains, flat static D-brains. In this space-time. How do these go up and down? Just pull them down? Or? Okay. Oh, this is not a... Okay. So, the definition of a D-brain is in fact very simple. It's defined by its simple property that a fundamental string can end on a D-brain. Okay, so if you have a D-brain lying along some surface in space, then B-brain is simply defined by the fact that if you have a fundamental string, it can end on the brain. Which means that whereas in the absence of D-brains, you only have strings which are closed. So in the absence of D-brain, you only have closed strings. But once D-brains are present, you can have open strings, because strings can end on D-brains. And this simple property is sufficient for describing all the properties of a D-brain. Okay, so although it doesn't look like much of a definition, one can show in string theory that by using various consistency relations, this property defines everything about a D-brain that you would like to know. Okay, so I'll first start by discussing some properties of D-brains in type 2A and type 2B string theory. The first property is that it has oriented D-brains, which are also known as BPS D-brains for P equal to even or odd. Okay. Which means that type 2A string theory has oriented D-brains only for DP brains. Oriented DP brains only for even P, and type 2B has oriented DP brains only for odd P. So type 2A, for example, has a D 0 brain, a D 2 brain, etc., and type 2B has D 1 brain, D 3 brain, etc. Okay, but besides this, these theories also have unoriented D brains or non BPS DP brains for P equal to odd or even. So it has D brains of all kinds. Every string, each of these type 2 and type 2B string theory has D brains of all kinds, but depending on whether you have P equal to even or odd, they are oriented or unoriented. Okay. Now, these D-brains have a nice feature that here all the states of the open string have mass square greater than or equal to 0. Okay. And this reflects the fact that these D-brains are stable. Okay. They don't decay away to something else. But if you examine the spectrum of open strings on unoriented D-brains or non-BPS D-brains, what one finds is that here, although most of the open string states have mass square positive or 0, there is one particular class of states, one open string state has mass square less than 0. Okay, one should really interpret this as one whole set of open string states, because each state of course carries momentum. Okay, so the state is labeled by momentum, but one particular class of states correspond to a particle of mass square less than 0. And the precise value of this mass square is minus 1 over 2 square root of alpha prime, okay, where alpha prime is the fundamental length parameter in string theory. Okay. And this state is known as a tachyon. And it's described by a field
of mass squared less than 0.
And we will see what this means in terms of the potential for the tachyon field. And because of the presence of this particle like state of mass square less than 0, we say that the non-BPSD brains are unstable. Yeah. The square, oh sorry, yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, now, so this looks like the appearance of the tachyon is a property of non-BPS or unoriented D-brains, but in fact, even in a system of oriented D-brains, you can get tachyons. Okay. And that happens when you bring two of the D-brains of opposite orientation too close to each other. So, if we have a coincident, pair of BPS D-brains, DP bar brains, okay, and DP bar here, okay, in we'll use the convention where DP bar brain is simply a D-brain with opposite orientation. Since BPS brains are oriented, we can certainly consider brains of two different orientations which are lying on top of each other. So we are considering a case where you have a DP brain and a D bar P brain. Okay. Now let me just draw them separated just for ease of visualizing what's happening, but you should really think of them as on top of each other. Now, since open strings can end on a D-brain, this system, okay, if you have a set of a DP and a DP bar put together, it has four different kinds of open strings, because first of all, open string can have both its ends on the DP brain. Open strings can have both its ends on the DP bar brain, but it can also have open strings which go, I should draw arrows here because even the fundamental strings here are oriented. It can have open strings which go from DP to DP bar or open strings which go from DP bar to DP. Yeah, D0 is a, yeah, okay, I really want to bring in charge here, okay, yeah, maybe, whenever BPS D brains also are characterized by the fact that they carry certain amount of charge, okay, and the brain of opposite, a DP bar brain carries exactly opposite amount of charge, okay, but as long as you are considering D brains of dimension larger than 1, larger than or equal to 1, okay, for example, D1 brain, D2 brain, etc., you can think of DP bar as simply when you have changed the orientation. You take a D1 brain and simply rotate it by 180 degree and put it on top, and that gives a DP bar brain. But as Steve just mentioned, this definition doesn't work for a D0 brain. Okay, so if we label these various sectors of open strings by A, B, C, and D, it turns out that sectors A and B, okay, these have states of mass square larger than or equal to 0, okay, but each of these sectors C and D, okay, which correspond to open strings stretched between two brains, okay, the D brain and the D bar brain, okay, these correspond to these have one state of mass square less than zero, and this also has one state of mass square less than zero. Okay. Again, when I say one state, it's a whole set of states labeled by its momentum. Okay, but it corresponds to just having one particular particle of mass square less than zero. Okay. And so again, we see that this system then has tachyons. Okay, because anytime you have particles of mass square less than zero, we call that we have a tachyon. And because there are two such states, okay, we have two different tachyon fields, okay, which we can call T1 and T2. Okay. We have two different tachyon fields, and it's customary to label it by one complex tachyon field instead of a real tachyon field, a set of two real tachyon fields. So we simply denote it by a complex tachyon field. Okay. Now let's see why does the existence of a tachyon denote this system is unstable. And this comes from a simple observation in quantum field theory that if V of T denotes the potential, energy density, of the tachyon field of any field, okay, which I am denoting by T, then V double prime of T at T equal to 0 is the mass square of the particle associated with the field. So, by the very fact that the tachyon has mass square less than 0, okay, this means that V double prime T at T equal to 0 is less than 0. And hence, V of T has a maximum at T equal to 0. Okay. I should perhaps have said that the V prime of T, of course, vanishes at T equal to 0. So if you plot V versus T, okay, if the tachyon is complex, you can just plot it against the real part of T. What this shows is that the potential has a maximum at T equal to 0, and this denotes instability because that means that the tachyon field can simply roll off this maximum and away from T equal to 0. Okay, and this is the source of instability. Okay, so the question that we will be interested in, okay, and the answer to which involves the various conjectures about tachyon condensation, is does V of T have a minimum? Okay. And we will try to address this question in both cases. Okay, for the brain anti-brain system as well as for the non-BPS brain. Now, before I discuss the conjectures, let me just say a few words about the symmetries of the potential. And one can show quite easily that on a non-BPS DP brain, V of t is equal to V of minus t, and on a DP bar system, V of t is invariant under a change of phase for any phi. So what we are going to discuss now is a set of conjectures which tells us what exactly happens at the minimum of V. So, I will state the conjectures in several parts. The first part of the conjecture, that the V of t does have minimum at some pair of values t equal to plus minus t 0 for non-BPS DP brain. It is clear that if it has one minimum, then it should have another minimum at minus t 0 because of the symmetry. And at t equal to t 0 e to the I phi for DP DP bar. Phi arbitrary angle. Pardon? Well, t naught could have been infinite, but at least as far as all the evidence goes, t naught seems to be finite. Okay, that it's, I mean all approaches T naught turns out to be a finite distance away from the origin.
That's the content conjecture.
Well, the conjecture by itself, at this stage we haven't said anything about a metric in the space of T, right? So you can always make a field definition which pushes it to infinity. So measured in some natural metric, it's at a finite distance. Okay, so that means that if you plot V versus T, you have some diagram like this. This is for non-BPS brain. And if you are interested in the brain, anti-brain system, you basically have to revolve it around the axis, okay, around the z-axis, because it's rotationally symmetric. Okay, but this part of the conjecture also has another statement, which is about the value of V at the minimum. And that says that this quantity is zero, okay, where EP is the total energy density, of the initial configuration. Okay, which amounts to saying that EP is TP, okay, this is the tension for non-BPSPN. And this is equal to twice TP for DP bar. Okay. So TP, the tension of a brain, is simply the energy per unit P volume of the brain. Okay. So if we have a non-BPS DP brain, we have started with a single brain. So the total energy per unit P volume is simply the tension of the original brain. Okay. If you have started with a DP bar system, then you have two brains to start with, okay, and hence the total energy density to begin with was two times the tension of each individual brain. Okay. So the conjecture then says that V of T naught plus TP should be 0 for a non-BPS brain, and V of T naught plus 2 times TP should be 0 for a brain anti-brain system. Okay. And this in turn means that at T equal to T naught, the total energy density is 0. Now the second conjecture in some sense is a natural follow-up of this first conjecture, but I'll state it separately because this turns up to the most difficult part of the conjecture to verify. This says that the physical interpretation of the vacuum of the minimum point T equal to T naught when T has gone down to T naught, okay, is simply that it describes vacuum without any dBN. Okay. It's natural from the point of view that if the total energy density is 0, okay, then it's natural to interpret the phenomenon of T equal to T naught, T rolling down to T naught, simply as saying that it simply corresponds to disappearance of the dBrain. Okay, the dBrain which was originally there is not there anymore. But on the other hand, this in turn implies that there are no physical open string states around T equal to T naught. Okay. Because once the dBrain has disappeared, I told you earlier that string theory normally contains only closed strings. Okay. And so if the dBrain has disappeared, okay, then there cannot be any open strings because open strings can end only on dBrains. Okay. And hence the T equal to T naught should not contain any open string states at all. And this is something which you normally don't see in a conventional field theory. Okay. In a conventional field theory, when you go from one point in field space to another point in field space, the total number of states, okay, at least perturbatively, do not change as you go down from one point to another. Okay. Here at this point, we had a dbrain, and a dbrain has infinite number of open string states living on it. Okay. Once you go down to this point, okay, this conjecture said that there are no open string states at all in this vacuum, okay, in t equal to t naught. So although it looks like a natural consequence of the first conjecture, I have stated it separately because this is the most difficult part to understand from the point of view of a field theory. Okay, and then the third part of the conjecture says that there are classical solutions of the equations of motion of t representing lower dimensional dbrains. Okay. So whereas t equal to t0 denotes a vacuum without any dbrain, we can consider non-trivial classical solutions involving t which describe lower dimensional dbrains. Okay, if you start with a dp brain, okay, or a dp dp bar system, you can get lower dimensional dbrains by considering classical solutions. And I'll just give some examples. Okay. The first example, okay, will be that you start with a non-BPS dp brain. And on this, a kink represents a BPS dp minus 1 brain. Okay. And these results hold irrespective of whether you are dealing with type 2A or type 2B string theory. Okay. Because in either theory, if you start with a non-BPS dp brain, okay, for an appropriate value of p, dp minus 1 brain is BPS, okay, because it alternates between even and odd, okay, the BPS and non-BPS. So this example says that if we take a non-BPS dp brain and consider a kink solution, then we get a BPS dp minus 1 brain. Okay. So pictorially, what this means is that if you consider a solution where t is not equal to t naught everywhere, but t approaches t naught asymptotically, okay, or plus minus t naught asymptotically, okay, and you consider a solution of this form, okay, that interpolates between plus and minus t naught, okay, then for such a solution, okay, we can first of all see that the energy density vanishes far away from x, okay, x is just one particular direction that we have taken. So you can see from here that because of the first conjecture, the energy density is 0 here, the total energy density. The total energy density is 0 here because t has become equal to t naught. Okay, and the energy density is concentrated around the x equal to 0 region. Okay. So this means that the energy density is localized around a co-dimension 1 subspace And the conjecture is that this describes, this particular solution describes a BPS DP minus 1 brain. Now this conjecture has a simple generalization to, okay, let me denote this by simple generalization to DP DP bar system. So on a DP DP bar system, a kink represents a non-BPS DP minus 1 brain. So the kink there, okay, takes the following form. You take, say, real part of T, or T is complex on a DP DP bar system. Take the real part of T, and again consider a solution where you interpolate between minus T naught to plus T naught. Okay. Now this solution is not topologically stable, okay, because T is a complex field and you have one whole circle of minimum rather than just two minimum. So this is unstable solution, okay, but that's okay because after all non-BPS DP minus 1 brain is also unstable. Okay. So a kink on a DP DP bar system describes an unstable solution representing an unstable non-BPS DP minus 1 brain. The third example is again that of a topologically stable solution. Okay. Which is that of a vortex on So the vortex is described by a solution of the form, if you denote by, so this is a codimension 2 brain, okay, so if you denote by rho and theta, the polar coordinates of a plane, okay, then T, okay, has the form of a function of rho times e to the I theta, okay, T is a complex field, okay, where this function of rho has the property that f of rho goes to T naught as rho goes to infinity, and this vanishes at rho equal to 0. Okay, so this is conventionally known as a vortex solution, okay, where the tachyon winds around at infinity, and this describes, this is a solution where the energy density is concentrated around rho equal to 0, okay, because as rho becomes large, the total energy density vanishes, T goes to T naught, and this describes a BPS DP minus 2 brain. Okay. And we can proceed this way, so you can consider various higher codimension solutions on larger number of brain anti-brain system, and we can generalize this conjecture to other DP brains, either BPS or non-BPS DP brains, as appropriate solutions involving the tachyon field on a higher dimensional brain. obviously. And one can generally argue that if we start from sufficient number of brains, then all lower dimensional D brains
can be regarded as solitons.
So here by solitons I'll simply refer to solutions of the classical equations of motion. So like either a kink or a vortex or more general solutions of classical equations of motion. And this description of D brains as solitons on higher dimensional brains is one route to classifying D brain charges using K theory. Okay. And this I think you will hear more about next week. Okay. So this leads to
of D brain charges in K theory, using K theory. Okay.
But I'll not discuss this in much more detail. What I'll focus on in these lectures is the dynamical question as to how exactly these solitons arise in string theory as exact solutions of the classical equations of motion. Now for this study it's simpler to go to a different string theory which has very similar properties, okay, but which provides a simpler setting for studying all three conjectures as stated. Okay. And that simpler string theory is bosonic string theory. Okay. So we study these conjectures in a simpler setting. Which is bosonic string theory. And this is defined in 25 space and one time dimension, unlike superstring theories which are defined in 9 space and one time dimensions. But this has, at least as far as the dynamics of D brains is concerned, or classical dynamics of D brains is concerned, this theory has very similar properties as superstring theory, okay, and that's the reason why this provides a much simpler setting for studying the same kind of problems. Okay. So what I'll do now then is to restate all the conjectures for D brains in bosonic string theory, okay, and then we'll try to see how to go about verifying these conjectures. So a bosonic string theory has unoriented D brains for all P less than or equal to 25. Okay. So So unlike in type 2 and type 2B string theory, where there are BPS and non-BPS brains in alternate dimensions, here all the D brains are non-BPS or unoriented, okay, and they exist for all values of P less than or equal to 25. The 25 brain being the one which fills up the whole space. Okay. Furthermore, each D brain, each DP brain has a single open string mode of mass square less than 0. Okay. It also of course has infinite number of other modes, but they all have mass square larger than or equal to 0. Okay. There is only one mode on each D brain of mass square less than 0. And this then means that we have a single tachyon field. And because there is only one such mode, we have a single real tachyon field, okay, which I will denote by T. Again, the existence of a tachyon field means that the potential V double prime of T at T equal to 0 is less than 0, because this after all is the mass square of the tachyon field, and hence V of T has a maximum. At T equal to 0. So locally if we plot V versus T, okay, it has a maximum. Okay. And again, we will be interested in knowing whether this potential has some minimum somewhere. Okay. And if it does, then what is the are the properties of that minimum? Okay. So it turns out that there are a very similar set of three conjectures which tells us how this potential behaves, so that it has a minimum, or if it does have a minimum, then what the theory behaves, how the theory behaves around that minimum. Okay. So what I will do now is to restate all the conjectures in the context of bosonic string theory. Okay, yeah, maybe I'll just bring it down. That's cool. Okay, so the first part, okay, says that V of T does have a minimum, but in this case, okay, it's a local minimum, okay, and not a global minimum. Okay. There is no symmetry, so there is a single minimum T equal to T naught, okay, and there are no BPS or non-BPS D brains, so the second part of conjecture is not necessary. Okay. So then this part of the conjecture said that V of T does have a local minimum at T equal to T naught. Now if you try to see how this diagram looks like, there is no symmetry of V under T goes to minus T. Okay. And in fact, this diagram now looks as follows. Okay. So this shows that this minimum is really just a local minimum. Okay. It's not a global minimum of the potential. And this, of course, causes problem in quantum theory. Okay. But as long as we are dealing with classical theory, and that's all we are focusing on in these lectures, okay, we can sit at this point, okay, and not worry about what's happening here. This remains exactly the same. Okay, V of T naught plus the total energy density is identically equal to 0. Okay. And total energy density in this case is simply the tension of the DP plane. Okay, because we are talking about a single D plane. Okay, this is a single real tachyon on a single D plane. Okay. So that T equal to T naught, again the total energy density is 0. Okay, in this part, the total energy density becomes negative. Okay. So the second part of the conjecture remains again the same, that T equal to T naught describes vacuum without any D plane. So rolling down to the minimum, since the total energy density is 0 at this point, it's quite natural to conjecture that this describes a vacuum where the D plane has completely disappeared. Okay. And hence, by the same logic, okay, since open strings exist only in the presence of D planes, once the D planes have disappeared, okay, once we know that there is no D plane, there should not be any physical open string state around T equal to T naught. And the third part of the conjecture is also more or less similar. But in this case, there is no topological stability of any of the solitons. So, for example, if you plot T, okay, let's consider T as a function of only one variable. In this case, we can consider a solution which asymptotically approaches T naught, but deviates from it near the origin. Again, by the same logic, at T equal to T naught, the total energy density is 0. So the energy density of this configuration is localized only around x equal to 0 region, because in this region total energy density is 0 by this conjecture. Okay, in this region the total energy density is 0. So this describes, okay, a solution in which the energy density is localized on a p minus 1 dimensional surface, okay, P minus 1 dimensional subspace, and this is conjecture to describes a DP minus 1 plane. Well, as long as it's a solution of the classical equations of motion, right, that means that the first derivative of the action with respect to T is 0. Okay. The second derivative, of course, is negative, but that's not something which should bother us, because every D brain is unstable, right? So certainly these solutions are not stable. Okay, it can either drop below or it can go this way. Okay, which means that on the lower, so if you consider the corresponding potential on the lower dimensional D brain. Yeah, okay, for codimension 1, they go exactly at 0 and comes back.
Right, okay.
Okay, but I think for codimension larger than 1, they even may go past the 0 and come back. But they certainly go past this. They certainly always go past this.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
Because these are like the bound solutions. If you invert the potential, then it's like you roll down like this and come back. So these are certainly unstable solutions, because it's clear that if you just disturb it a little bit, it will roll down this way. Okay. So in terms of the configuration that is here, you can pull it a little bit down, okay, it rolls down. Okay, that in that language, okay, see that V you can also interpret as the potential on dP minus 1 brain, right? Because it's the same shape of the potential on every D brain. So disturbing it this way, in that language, means that you are pushing it to the left. Okay. Disturbing it this way means that you are pushing it to the right. You come back to the vacuum, T equal to T naught. Okay. So clearly, all of these solutions are unstable. But since you are studying classical dynamics, okay, you are just using this as a guideline to get insight about superstrings, okay, at the classical level. Okay, this doesn't bother us that the solutions are unstable. So this is an example of a codimension 1 lump, but you can consider also codimension 2 lumps, okay, where you take, you simply rotate this around the axis, okay, of course the shape will change, okay, that will describe a dP minus 2 brain, okay, you can consider a codimension 3 lump, okay, that will describe a dP minus 3 brain and so on and so on, 3 brain and so on. Okay. So again, as I said, that the reason that we are studying bosonic string theory is simply because these results are very analogous, these conjectures are very analogous to the corresponding conjectures in superstring theory. And at the classical level, bosonic string theory is easier to handle than superstring theories. Okay. And so one believes that whatever insight you get by studying bosonic string theory, you can apply to superstrings. And indeed, some of the results that I'll be discussing have been generalized also to superstrings directly using the string field theory. Okay, so now then we turn to verification of these conjectures. Okay. And various methods have been used to study various parts of these conjectures. I'll just list some approaches. First of all, we have the techniques of 2D conformal field theory. Then we have renormalization group approach. And then you have two versions of string field theory, boundary string field theory.
and cubic string field theory.
Now, it turns out that although of all the three conjectures, this third part of the conjecture looks more involved, okay, because here you are not dealing with a solution which is independent of space-time, but which depends on spatial coordinates. This, in fact, is the easiest to study in most of the approaches. Okay. And these approaches have been most successful in verifying the third part of the conjecture. Okay. In fact, one can explicitly prove third part of the conjecture by using these approaches. Okay. Namely, that the lower dimensional d-branes arise as solitons, classical solutions on higher dimensional d-branes. Bounded string field theory has been successful in verifying 1 and 3. Okay. And at present, at least, the only approach which seems to be suitable for attacking all three aspects of the problem is this one. Okay. Because this really fully takes into account all the degrees of freedom of the string. But there is a price to pay for this. Okay. Although this approach has been most successful in verifying, in addressing in particular the second part of the conjecture, namely disappearance of the open string states. Okay. The price that one has to pay for this is, so far, most of the concrete results that have come out of this are numerical. Okay. So most concrete results are numerical. Okay. Whereas in these approaches, one has an explicit analytic handle on the various conjectures, okay, in particular conjecture 3 and also conjecture 1. So, in the rest of my talk, I'll focus mostly on this approach, okay, because as I said, that this has the most amount of flexibility. Okay, although it's most complicated, okay, it has the most amount of flexibility to address all three questions. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, so let's then start by asking why we need string field theory. Okay, and what, after all, is string field theory? Why string field theory? And the answer to this lies in the fact that so far, when we are discussing condensation of tachyons on, or the tachyonic solutions on the d-brane, we have been pretending as if the tachyon is the only dynamical field in the system. But in practice, tachyon is only one of infinite number of fields on a d-brane, okay, because open strings living on the d-brane has infinite number of states. And to describe the full dynamics of the d-brane, you really have to consider the dynamics of those infinite number of states, okay, which gives rise to infinite number of fields. Okay. So, in actual practice, the dynamics of a d-brane is governed by a field theory with infinite number of fields. And these infinite number of fields are of course associated with infinite number of states of the open string. Okay. And the tachyon is just one of these infinite number of fields. So when we look for solutions of the equations of motion, okay, we really are looking for solutions of equations, okay, which are infinite in number and which couples all the infinite number of fields in a complicated way. Okay. So, equations of motion really correspond to infinite number of equations infinite number of coupled equations in these infinite number of fields okay. And as I said, the tachyon is just one of these infinite number of fields which appear in the system okay. So we cannot really solve the equations of motion for the tachyon okay, as by itself. Okay. If we really want to solve the full set of equations of motion, we need to look at the set of coupled equations for this infinite number of fields. Now, what this boundary string field theory approach does okay, is to make a clever choice of variables where the equations decouple. Okay. So that you can actually try to solve the equations of motion for the tachyon without worrying about the equations of motion for the other fields. Okay. And that indeed can be done. Okay. And that's the reason we get an analytic handle on the problem. Okay. But if we are trying to study, for example, fluctuations, the spectrum of open strings around the particular solution, in particular the tachyon vacuum solution, then we really need to study how this infinite number of open string states behave near the tachyon vacuum. Because after all, we had infinite number of fields, and we really need to study how the infinite number of fields behave around the tachyon vacuum. And that there is no systematic way of studying within the context of boundary string field theory. Okay, we really need to put back all the infinite number of fields and their coupling to the tachyon field if you want to study this problem. And this is one reason why boundary string field theory has been successful with problems with conjectures 1 and 3, but not with conjecture 2. So what we'll do is to directly head on try to tackle these infinite number of coupled equations in infinite number of fields. Okay. And this is what leads us to string field theory. Okay. The classical equations of motion of string field theory are precisely these infinite number of equations in infinite number of fields. So the task then is first of all to take a precise formulation of string field theory okay. Then we make a set of conjectures
in this string field theory.
It's clear that we have to restate the set of conjectures in the string field theory, because now we are no longer talking about just the equation of motion for one variable, but the equation of motion for infinite number of coupled variables. Okay, so you have to make some precise conjectures about what, or precise statements about what these conjectures mean for these equations. Okay, and then we have to try to verify these conjectures.
How much time can I take? Okay, so I can go on till 12? Okay, thanks.
Okay, so what we are going to do then is to first try to make a precise formulation of string field theory, okay, what string field theory means. But before we do that, we have to set up the background by discussing what a open string theory, a first quantized open string theory amounts to. Okay, how is it described? Okay, so we first discuss quantized bosonic string theory. Okay, and Debrandt's in that string theory. Yeah, this is one string, exactly. Okay, I mean, the point is we are trying to describe string theory in terms of one string, exactly. Okay, so quantum theory of a single string. Now, we want to describe quantum theory of a single string. At least we want to make the setup somewhat general. So, we want to describe quantum field theory of a single string in some arbitrary space-time background. Okay. So, the space-time background, okay, or the possible space-time backgrounds for the string, okay, turns out to be in one-to-one correspondence with a two-dimensional conformal field theory, which I'll denote by CFT, okay. And this conformal field theory, okay, splits into a product of two conformal field theories. One I'll call CFT matter and other CFT ghost. This has central charge 26 and this has central charge minus 26. Okay. All information about what space-time background we are dealing with is encoded in this part of the conformal field theory. Okay. All space-time backgrounds are described by the same universal ghost conformal field theory. Okay. This doesn't change as you go from one space-time background to another space-time background. Okay. So this contains information
about space-time background.
This part, okay, the CFT ghost contents is described by a set of fields, okay, because this is universal, we can write it down once and for all. The set of fields one can denote by B bar, C and C bar. Okay. So B has conformal weight 2, 0. Okay, these are conformal weights, the left and right conformal weights. B bar has 0, 2. C has minus 1, 0, and C bar has 0, minus 1. Okay, these are conformal weights. And it follows from this assignment of conformal weights that this has total central set minus 26. Okay, now if we are studying a closed string theory, okay, the states of a closed string. Are described by states of this CFT on the sphere, okay, or the complex plane with points at infinity identified. But we are interested in describing the states of an open string. Okay, I should perhaps have said something else, that in particular if we consider flat space-time background, okay, the corresponding conformal field theory, okay, CFT matter is a free field theory of 26 scalar fields. Okay, these 26 scalar fields are just the 26 coordinates of space-time. Okay, so if we want to study the closed strings in flat space-time, okay, you take this free field theory of 26 scalar fields on a sphere or a complex plane, okay, and study the states of that complex of this conformal field theory. Okay, and those states will correspond, will give rise to states of the closed string, okay, with some constraints that I am going to discuss later. Yeah, okay, so the point is you start with a cylinder, okay, so the states, you define the closed string propagation by considering an infinite cylinder, okay, but then you can go to the complex plane, okay, if this is W, the standard procedure is to describe this, map this to the complex plane by simply taking Z equal to W, okay, so, okay, this is again something which is conventional data in conformal field theory that when you talk about states on the sphere, okay, the states propagate radially outwards. Okay, so the time evolution of the states, okay, which on the cylinder will be along this direction, okay, will be states which are propagating radially outwards. No, the vortex supporters are independent of the genus. Okay, the see you have to okay to talk about states, you have to give it a you have to consider a state space. Okay, and you define a state space by considering a sphere. Okay, you can okay. The point is, if you take a closed surface, okay, any other closed driven surface, you can still define a state space by around a given point. Okay, you start from there and you propagate radially outwards.
Okay.
Yeah, it will be the same state space, exactly. Yeah. Okay. But okay, we are going to distinguish this from surfaces with boundaries. Okay, because those will describe open strings. Okay. Okay, since I have drawn this anyway, one can also draw the corresponding diagram for the open strings. So open strings propagate along a strip rather than a cylinder because strings have ends. Okay. And at these boundaries, we have to put appropriate boundary condition corresponding to open strings, and I will discuss that soon. So again, if you draw, call this the W plane, and you define Z equal to the W, okay, this gets mapped to the upper half plane. And this is the boundary, the two boundaries here get mapped to the real axis. Okay. So open strings, states of the open string are described by states of CFT on the upper half plane, okay, or the strip. Okay, this description makes it clear that we are really talking about open strings. Okay. But in order to define conformal field theory on the upper half plane, okay, we need boundary conditions. On the real axis. Okay. And different boundary conditions, different possible conformal invariant boundary conditions give size to different d-planes. Yeah, you have to put boundary condition on the Gauss sector as well. But again, as the Gauss conformal field theory is universal, the boundary condition on the Gauss are also universal. Okay, so the the coupling between, no, see they are, as conformal field theory, they are totally decoupled. Okay. It's just a tensor product of matter and ghost. Exactly. Yeah, okay, so I'm talking about backgrounds which can be described by standard conform all field theories. Okay, not yeah. So there are some special kinds of backgrounds which might couple matter and ghost, but I'm considering here backgrounds which doesn't do that. Okay, so a conformal field theory with boundary condition with specific boundary condition on the real axis, okay, I'll denote by boundary CFT. Okay, or BCFT. So whenever I talk about a BCFT, it comes with its own boundary condition. Okay, so BCFT means that you have also already specified boundary condition, and this then means that D brains are in one-to-one correspondence with various BCFTs corresponding to the same bulk conformal field theory. Okay, we take the same conformal field theory, we can put it on the conformal field theory, we can put it on the upper half plane. And because we can put different boundary conditions on fields on the real axis, we get different possible D brains. Well, this is the way we normally define D brains. Okay, a given D brain is described by putting a specific boundary condition on the fields. Okay, and yeah, in the flat case, all D brains have been classified, and the boundary conditions that one puts are Neumann or Dirichlet, or you can put mixed boundary conditions. But mixed boundary conditions correspond to D brain with some electric or magnetic field on them. Okay. So all D brains have been, described by using appropriate boundary conditions. Okay. And then I should just mention what I have already said, that the ghost part has the same boundary condition for all D brains. Okay. So then this means that when we are trying to describe the states of an open string living on some particular D brain, what you are talking about are states of a particular boundary conformal field theory on the upper half plane. Correspond to states of a particular BCFT on the upper half plane. Well, I'll not describe this in detail, but I can give some examples, maybe. Okay. So take the free field theory. X0 to X25. These are the 26 scalars which are associated with the 26 space-time coordinates. Okay. Now, if we consider a particular x mu, okay, we can, let's consider two possible choices. Okay, although as I said, there are more general choices. We can either put a Dirichlet boundary condition or a Neumann boundary condition. Okay. If we put a Dirichlet boundary condition, okay, let's say x mu equal to x naught mu at the boundary. This means that the ends of the open string are pinned at x naught mu, okay, because the ends of the open string are, after all, the boundaries. Okay, so the ends of the open string are pinned at x naught mu. Okay, so x mu must denote then a direction transverse to the D plane. Okay. Let's just consider x mu, and this is the surface x mu equal to x naught mu. Okay. So if the ends of the open string are pinned at x naught mu, that means that the ends of the open string are constant to move on x equal to x naught mu surface. Okay. So this x mu then denotes a direction transverse to the D plane. So this denotes transverse to D plane, okay, and here if you put Neumann boundary condition, then x mu is not pinned at any particular value, and this denotes directions parallel to the D plane. Okay. So let's consider some examples. Suppose we want a static D1 plane along x1 at x2 equal to 0, x3 equal to 0, up to x25 equal to 0. For describing such a D plane, we put Dirichlet boundary condition x mu equal to 0, okay, for mu equal to 2, 3, up to 25, and we put Neumann boundary condition on x0 and x1. Okay, that's one way we will describe a D1 plane, okay, which is localized at x2 equal to 0 up to x25 equal to 0. And this can be generalized to arbitrary plane configurations.
No, but my question is rather different. I mean, if I were in the realm of differential equations, I might tell you you were studying the Laplace equation on the upper half plane, and I went in elliptic boundary conditions that are local, and then there's a well-defined criterion to describe all of them. I'm wondering, in this context, what is the criterion that determines all the boundaries?
Okay, the criteria is that you have to also maintain conformal invariance of the full theory. Mm-hmm. Okay, for free field theory, you can put, I mean, either Dirichlet boundary condition or Neumann boundary condition or mixed boundary condition. Okay, linear mixed boundary condition. So that, I mean, all boundary conditions are allowed and they give proper D-plane configurations. Okay. For interacting theory, of course, things are more complicated. Okay, and there you write in abstract language. Okay, there are certain set of criteria which you have to use to make sure that the theory is conformal invariant. Okay, so that's the main criteria for choosing what kind of boundary conditions you allow.
Okay.
Yeah, local boundary condition, exactly. Okay. But for free field theory, you can put Dirichlet or Neumann or any linear combination of Dirichlet and Neumann. Okay, it's not necessary that you take a linear subspace, but if you don't take a linear subspace, the theory is not conformal invariant. Okay. So it will not remain static. Okay, it will start, moving, for example. That's right, yeah, it has to be exactly. It has to be written. It can be subtorus, but it can simply wind infinite number of times. Yeah, it can keep winding. Yeah. Okay, so let's consider then, let's define. Okay, so suppose we have taken a particular D brain, okay, and let's define H to be the vector space of states. On CFT matter times CFT ghost, or okay, I should say BCFT matter plus times BCFT ghost. Okay, just to indicate that we are talking about open string states and not closed string states. So H basically has the tensor product structure H matter times H ghost. Okay. And this Hilbert space has a unique SL2R invariant vacuum, invariant state or state. Okay, we don't need to call it vacuum. Which I'll denote by 0. Okay. And by the usual property of conformal field theory, what one can, so that for every state in H, okay, there is a local operator, there is a local boundary operator. Such that phi is phi at 0 on the vacuum. Okay, so you can define this local boundary operator anywhere on the real axis, but the state phi is created by acting with the operator at 0 on the vacuum. I'll define a ghost number, which is an integer for any state, okay, and that's defined as follows. So first of all, the vacuum has ghost number 0, B and B bar has ghost number minus 1, and C and C bar has ghost number 1. Okay. And all matter has ghost number 0. Thank you. So these four criteria are enough to describe the ghost number of any state in the state space of matter times ghost. Okay, because we simply look at the ghost number of the operator phi, okay, that is creating the state out of the vacuum, and we assign that as the ghost number of the state. Okay. And we will use the notation that Hn is the subspace of H. With ghost number n. Okay. And with this, we can now make a precise statement of what are the physical states of an open string. Living on a D-brain. Okay. First of all, it satisfies that it is a state in H1. Okay. Second, it satisfies the relation QB on phi equal to 0. Okay, I'll say a few words about QB. QB is a ghost number 1 nilpotent operator. It can be written, one can write down definite expression for QB in terms of the ghost fields and matter pairs or the generators. Okay, but will not need to know the explicit expression for QB. Okay, it's just enough to know that this conformal field theory, the boundary conformal field theory, has an operator QB of ghost number 1, which is nilpotent, and the physical states are required to satisfy that they are annihilated by QB. And finally, there is an equivalence relation that given phi prime satisfying QB phi equal to 0. The QB phi prime. Okay. We say that phi and phi prime are equivalent if phi minus phi prime equal to QB lambda. So these three criteria describe the physical states of an open string on a D-brain. Yeah.
I have a vague memory from when I was learning this conversation string theory that there was some condition involving B0 minus B0 bar on the state in the bench.
Okay. See, first of all, here you are talking about open strings. Okay. So there is only one B0. Okay. So. Yeah, we also restate these conditions for closed string because there are two different kinds of BRST charge there. You get a Q and Q bar, for example. But for open strings, this is the setup criteria. That's right, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so this then gives the spectrum of single open strings in string theory. Okay, but these three criteria generate the spectrum of single open strings in string theory. Now I'll end by stating what string field theory is supposed to do. So, an open string field theory is a field theory such that the following two conditions hold. The gauge inequivalent solutions of linearized field equations, I should say classical field equations, should be in one-to-one correspondence with the physical states of the open string. And this simply follows from the fact that if we have a classical field theory, okay, and we have a set of gauge inequivalent solutions of linearized equations of the classical field theory, then those solutions, okay, are in one-to-one correspondence with the particle spectrum in that field theory when you quantize it, okay, at least at the perturbative level. Okay. And so we want our string field theory to be such that when we quantize the string field theory, okay, then we should recover the usual particle spectrum. The usual spectrum of open strings that we see in this description. Okay. And so this criteria is something that one has to impose on a string field theory. Okay. The second criteria is more ambitious. Well, the physical, okay, I mean,
before or after taking the question,
by U1 action? By which U1 action? Okay, yeah, so these, yeah, so you remove the phase, yeah, so physical states are, you know, exactly, yeah, okay. So, okay, here also you should modify by overall scaling, okay. So, I mean, in both, as you will see, I mean, in both cases, right, I mean, here there is a overall scaling, and there you can simply scale the wave function by a phase, okay, and those have to be removed, okay, or you put them back in both cases. So the second criteria is that S matrix elements computed from string field theory using Feynman rules Okay. So here the point is that even without using string field theory, there is a well-defined rules for calculating S matrix element in string theory, just as sum over Riemann surfaces with boundaries. And those rules give specific expressions for various S matrix elements in string theory. And we better make sure that the open string field theory that we are formulating reproduces exactly the same S matrix elements. Okay, because otherwise it's not describing the string theory that you want to describe. Given a string field theory that satisfies these criteria, we can then use that string field theory to study problems that we are interested in particular, say, problem of tachyon condensation, okay, studying the potential for the tachyon. So what I'll do next time is to write down a string field theory which satisfies these criteria, and then we'll see how we can use that string field theory to study the tachyon condensation problem that we are interested in. I think I'll stop here. Yeah.
One last question for WDW. Can you
give
some examples of boundary conditions?
Yeah, you can certainly write down explicit, deep-brain states in WZW models, exactly. But if you really are, considering interacting, string theory, that you don't think in terms of boundary conditions, okay, directly written on fields, okay. But there are abstract ways of dealing with boundary conditions, in conformal field theory, okay. So you use those abstract definitions of a boundary conformal field theory to see what are the consistent boundary conformal field theories in the background of a WZW model. And that classifies a set of D-brains in WZW models. Yeah, these are basically, you can consider the limit where the, let's take SU2 group manifold, okay, and where the group manifold is large. You take the limit where you have a large size sphere. And then these are D-brains, okay, the brains wrapped on specific specific planes parallel to the equator. Okay, so these are the kinds of D-brains that one gets in WZW model. So in the large volume limit, you can give interpretation in terms of actual putting boundary conditions on the fields. Okay. But the whole construction is more general. Okay, so that you can also talk about D-brains in small group manifolds.